way I see it, there are three reasons never to be unhappy. First, you were born. This in itself is a remarkable achievement. Did you know that each time your father ejaculated, he produced roughly 25 million spermatozoa, enough to repopulate Britain every 2 days or so? For you to have been born, not only did you have to be among the few batches of sperm that even had a theoretical chance of prospering, in itself quite a long shot, but you then had to win a race against 24,999,999 or so other wriggling contenders, all rushing to swim the English Channel of your mother's thingamy in order to be the first ashore at the fertile egg of Boulogne, as it were. Being born was easily the most remarkable achievement of your whole life. And think, you could just as easily have been a flatworm. Second, you are alive. For the tiniest moment in the span of eternity, you have the miraculous privilege to exist. For endless eons, you were not. Soon you will cease to be once more. That you are able to sit here right now in this one never-to-be-repeated moment, listening to me read this book, eating bonbons, dreaming about hot sex with that scrumptious person from accounts, speculatively sniffing your armpits, doing whatever you are doing, just existing, is really wondrous beyond belief. Third, you have plenty to eat. You live in a time of peace, and tie a yellow ribbon round the old oak tree will never be number one again. If you bear these things in mind, you will never be truly unhappy. Though, in fairness, I must point out that if you find yourself alone in Weston-super-Mare on a rainy Tuesday evening, you may come close. It was only a little after 6 when I stepped from the Exeter train and ventured into the town, but already the whole of Weston appeared to be indoors beyond drawn curtains. The streets were empty, dark, and full of slanting rain. I walked from the station, through a concrete shopping precinct, and out onto the front, where a black, unseen sea made restless whooshing noises. Most of the hotels along the front were dark and empty, and the few that were open didn't look particularly enticing. I walked a mile or so to a cluster of 3 brightly lit establishments at the far end of the promenade, and randomly selected a place called the Birchfield. It was fairly basic, but clean and reasonably priced. You could do worse, and I have. I gave myself a cursory grooming and wandered back into town in search of dinner and diversion. I had an odd sense that I had been here before, which patently I had not. My only acquaintance with Weston was that John Cleese had once told me, oh, I'm not really dropping names, I was interviewing him for a newspaper article, he's a jolly nice fellow, by the way, that he and his parents lived in a flat in Weston, and that when they moved out, Geoffrey Archer and his parents moved in, which I thought was kind of remarkable. The idea of these 2 boys in short trousers saying hello, and then one of them going on to greatness. What made Weston feel familiar, of course, was that it was just like everywhere else. It had Boots and Marks and Spencer and Dixon's and W.H. Smith and all the rest of it. I realized with a kind of dull ache that there wasn't a single thing here that I hadn't seen a million times already. I went into a pub called the Britannia Inn, which was unfriendly without actually being hostile, and had a couple of lonely pints, then ate at a Chinese restaurant, not because I craved Chinese, but because it was the only place I could find open. I was the only customer. As I quietly scattered rice and sweet and sour sauce across the tablecloth, there were some rumbles of thunder, and a moment later the heavens opened. And I mean opened. I have seldom seen it rain so hard in England. The rain spattered the street like a shower of ball bearings, and within minutes the restaurant window was wholly obscured with water, as if someone were running a hose over it. Because I was a long walk from my hotel, I spun out the meal, hoping the weather would ease off, but it didn't, and eventually I had no choice but to step out into the rainy night. I stood beneath a shop awning next door and wondered what to do. Rain battered madly on the awning and rushed in torrents through the drains. All along the road it poured over the sides of overstretched gutters and fell to the pavement in an endless clatter. With my eyes closed, it sounded like I was in the midst of some vast, insane tap-dancing competition. Pulling my jacket above my head, I stepped out into the night. I had just a moment to note that the street was completely flooded, evidently from a clogged drain, when a red Fiesta sped through a puddle at great speed and unusually close to the curb, transferring nearly all of the water from the puddle and on to me. To say that I was drenched barely hints at my condition. I was as soaked as if I had fallen into the sea. As I stood there spluttering and gasping, the car slowed. 3 close-cropped heads popped out the windows, shouted some happy greeting along the lines of, yeah, and sped off. Glumly, I walked back along the prom, squelching with each step and shivering with cold. I don't wish to reduce this cheery chronicle to pathos, but I had only recently recovered from a fairly serious bout of pneumonia. And I won't say that I nearly died, but I was ill enough to watch This Morning with Richard and Judy, and I certainly didn't want to be in that condition again. To add to my indignity, the Fiesta came past on a victory lap, and its pleasure-starved occupants slowed to offer me another triumphal nyee-nyee before speeding off into the night with a screech and a brief uncontrolled fishtail slide that unfortunately failed to bury them in a lamppost. By the time I reached my distant hotel, I was feeling thoroughly chilled and wretched. So imagine my consternation, if you will, when I discovered that the reception area was in semi-darkness and the door was locked. I looked at my watch. It was only 9 o'clock, for pity's sake. What kind of town was this? There were 2 doorbells, and I tried them both, but without response. I tried my room key in the door, and of course it didn't work. I tried the bells again, leaning on them both for many minutes and growing increasingly angry. When this elicited no satisfaction, I banged on the glass door with the flat of my hand, then with a fist, and finally with a stout boot and a touch of frenzy. I believe I may also have filled the quiet streets with shouting. Eventually, the proprietor appeared at the top of some basement stairs, looking surprised. "I'm so sorry, sir," he said mildly as he unlocked the door and let me in. "Have you been out there long?" Well, I blush to think at how I ranted at the poor man. I used immoderate language. I sounded like Graham Taylor before they let him off and took away his warm-up suit. I accused him and his fellow townspeople of appalling shortages of intelligence and charm. I told him that I had just passed the dreariest evening of my life in this godforsaken hellhole of a resort, that I had been soaked to the skin by a carful of young men who between them were 10 points short of a moron, that I had walked a mile in wet clothes, and had now spent nearly half an hour shivering in the cold because I had been locked out of my own hotel at 9 o'clock in the evening. "May I remind you," I went on in a shrill voice, "that 2 hours ago you said goodbye to me, watched me go out the door, and disappear down the street. Did you think I wasn't coming back? That I would sleep in a park and return for my things in the morning? Or is it merely that you are a total imbecile? Please tell me, because I would very much like to know." The proprietor flinchingly soaked up my abuse and responded with fluttering hands and a flood of apologies. He offered me a tray of tea and sandwiches, to dry and press my wet clothes, to escort me to my room and turn on my radiator personally. He did everything but fall to my feet and beg me to run him through with a saber. He positively implored me to let him bring me something warming on a tray. "I don't want anything but to go to my room and count the minutes until I get out of this friggin' dump," I shouted, perhaps a trifle theatrically, but to good effect, and stalked up the stairs to the first floor, where I plodded about heatedly in the corridor for some minutes and realized that I didn't have the faintest idea which was my room. There was no number on the key. I returned to the reception area, now once more in semi-darkness, and put my head to the basement door. "Excuse me," I said in a small voice. "Could you please tell me what room I'm in?"
"Number 27, sir,"
came a voice from the darkness. I stood for some time without moving. "Thank you."
"It's quite all right, sir. Have a good night."
"Thank you," I said again, and retired to my room, where the night passed without further incident. In the morning, I presented myself in the sunny dining room, and as I had feared, the proprietor was waiting to receive me. Now that I was dry and warm and well-rested, I felt terrible about my outburst of the night before.
"Good morning, sir,"
he said brightly, as if nothing had happened, and showed me to a window table with a nice view of the sea.
"Sleep all right, did you?"
I was taken aback by his friendliness. Yes, I did, as a matter of fact."
"Good, splendid. Juice and cereal on the trolley. Please help yourself. Can I get you the full English breakfast, sir?"
I found this unmerited bonhomie unbearable. I tucked my chin into my chest, and in a furtive grumble said, "Look here, I'm very sorry for what I said last night. I was in a bit of a temper."
"It's quite all right, sir."
"No, really, I'm very sorry. I'm a bit ashamed, in fact."
"Consider it forgotten, sir. So, full English breakfast, is it?"
"Yes, please."
"Very good, sir."
I've never had such good or friendly service anywhere, or felt more like a worm. He brought my food promptly, chattering away about the weather and what a glorious day it promised to be. I couldn't understand why he was so forgiving. Only gradually did it occur to me what a strange sight I must have presented, a middle-aged man with a rucksack, visiting a place like Weston, out of season, for no evident reason, fetching up at their hotel and bellowing and stomping about over a trifling inconvenience. He must have thought I was mad, an escaped lunatic, perhaps, and that this was the safest way to approach me. Either that, or he was just an extremely nice person. In either case, I salute him now. You know, I've never had a train conversation that wasn't disastrous, or at least regretted. I either blurt the wrong thing, "Oh, excuse me, I can't help but notice the exceptional size of your nose," or it turns out that the person whose companionship I've encouraged has a serious mental disorder that manifests itself in murmurings and prolonged helpless weeping, or is a sales rep for the Hose Blow Stucco Company who mistakes your polite interest for keenness and promises to drop by for an estimate the next time he's in the Dales, or who wants to tell you all about his surgery for rectal cancer and then makes you guess where he keeps his colostomy bag. Give up. Look, it's here under me arm. Go on, have a squeeze. Or is a recruiter for the Mormons, or any of 10,000 other things I would sooner be spared. Over a long period of time, it gradually dawned on me that the sort of person who will talk to you on a train is almost by definition the sort of person you don't want to talk to on a train. So these days, I mostly keep to myself and rely for conversational entertainment on travel books by Paul Theroux. So, there's a certain neat irony that as I was sitting there minding my own business, some guy in a rustling anorak came by, spied my book, and cried,
"Aha! That thorough chap!"
I looked up to find him taking a perch on a seat opposite me. He looked to be in his early 60s, with a shock of white hair and festive, lushly overgrown eyebrows that rose in pinnacles like the tips of whipped meringue. They looked as if somebody had been lifting him up by grabbing hold of them.
"Doesn't know his trains, you know," he said.
"Sorry," I answered warily.
"Thorough,"
he nodded at my book.
"Doesn't know his trains at all, or if he does, he keeps it to himself."
He laughed heartily at this, and enjoyed it so much that he said it again, and then sat with his hands on his knees and smiling, as if trying to remember the last time he and I had had this much fun together. I gave an economical nod of acknowledgement for his quip, and returned my attention to my book in a gesture that I hoped he would correctly interpret as an invitation to sod off. Instead, he reached across and pulled the book down with a crooked finger, an action I find deeply annoying at the best of times.
"Do you know that book of his? Great Railway, what's it? You know, All Across Asia. You know that one?"
I nodded.
"Do you know that in that book, he goes from Lahore to Islamabad on the Delhi Express and never once mentions the make of engine?"
I could see that I was expected to comment, so I said, "Oh.
Never mentioned it. Can you imagine that? What use is a railway book if you don't talk about the engines?"
"You like trains, then," I said, and immediately wished I hadn't. The next thing I knew, the book was on my lap, and I was listening to the world's most boring man. I didn't actually much listen to what he said. I found myself riveted by his soaring eyebrows and by the discovery that he had an equally rich crop of nose hairs. He seemed to have bathed them in miracle grow. He wasn't just a train spotter, but a train talker, a far more dangerous condition.
"Now, this train is a Metro Camel self-sealed unit built at the Swindon Works at a guess, I'd say, between July 1986 and August, or at the very latest September of 88. At first, I thought it couldn't be a Swindon 86-88 because of the cross-stitching on the seat backs, but then I noticed the dimpled rivets on the side panels, and I thought to myself, I thought, what we have here, Cyril, me old son, is a hybrid. There aren't many certainties in this world, but Metro Camel dimpled rivets never lie. So, where's your home?"
It took me a moment to realize that I'd been asked a question. Skipton, I said.
"Ooh, you'll have Cross and Blackwell Cross Cambers up there," he said, or something similarly meaningless. "No, me, I live in Upton-on-Severn."
"The Severn Boar," I said reflexively, but he missed my meaning.
"That's right. Runs right past the house. Now, down there, we have Z46 Sanusi spin cycles with Abbott and Costello horizontal thrusters. You can always tell a Z46 because they go patouche-patouche over seamed points rather than katoink-katoink. It's a dead giveaway every time. I bet you didn't know that."
I ended up feeling sorry for him. His wife had died 2 years before, suicide, I would guess, and he had devoted himself since then to traveling the rail lines of Britain, counting rivets, noting breastplate numbers, and doing whatever else it is these poor people do to pass the time until God takes them away to a merciful death.